Costner, representing the state, which was the plaintiff appellant in the Court of Appeals and the petitioner before this court in this criminal case. As often happens, a relatively modest case, or at least a case with modest beginnings, has produced an issue of great importance. Philip Cannon testified at a trial in March of 1998 that he was not the driver of his pickup truck 2 years earlier on the 4th of July when he was arrested in Taylor County and charged in that county with sixth offense OWI, operating with a prohibited alcohol concentration, and fourth offense operating after revocation. The state believes that Mr. Cannon's testimony at his criminal traffic trial was false, and it charged Mr. Cannon with perjury. The state seeks the opportunity of proving the perjury charge at a trial, not simply by representing or retrying the first case, by simply representing the evidence from the first criminal traffic trial, but by using new evidence not known and not available at the time of the traffic trial, that being an admission by Mr. Cannon that he was the driver and had falsely blamed his passenger for being the driver at the time of the arrest.
I know that the witness came forth after the conviction, but was the defendant's statement in the bar before or after his conviction?
That's right, Your Honor. No, his statement in the bar was before his traffic trial and before his acquittal. It did not come to light until after.
Okay.
It was brought
to... Does it matter whether it was before or after the trial, or what matters is when it was brought to light?
In our view, Your Honor, under the rule that we are proposing and under the well-established rule for newly discovered evidence, which we are urging this court to adopt for application in this case, it does not matter that the statement was made by Mr. Cannon before his trial. What matters is when it came to light and when it reasonably could have come to light.
When you say reasonably could come to light, is that tantamount to saying when that it was available or unavailable, those kind of buzzwords?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think the question is whether or not through reasonable diligence it could have been discovered, or frankly should have been discovered. That's the kind of, the state's in an unusual position here. Typically, we're arguing, opposing motions for new trial on the grounds of newly discovered evidence, that a defendant must meet all of the criteria, and one of those criteria, of course, is that the defendant not have been negligent in failing to discover the evidence. We're perfectly willing to go before any court and say that the prosecution in this case was not negligent in not knowing that a month after the arrest, Mr. Cannon had admitted in a bar in Cudahy, a couple hundred miles away from Taylor County, that he had lied at the time of his arrest. We don't think the state was negligent in not knowing that.
Well, except the person that came forward here, as I understand the facts, was a friend of the other person who was allegedly alone, as well as they were kind of waiting to see what the outcome of the trial was. If the trial had gone the other way, this statement probably would never have come to light.
That it's entirely possible, Your Honor. The state had no control over when Quesada would write his letter. He apparently wrote his letter to the authorities in Taylor County only after, it was a month after Mr. Cannon had gone to trial and been acquitted. And it was only then that he wrote the letter. There's no question about that.
The timing. The disclosure was before, but I'm talking about the conversation was before, but the actual disclosure was made.
Right. The words were uttered by Mr. Cannon before his trial. The fact that the words were uttered did not come to light until after his trial.
This is just an aside, but you said you can stand and say the state was not negligent in discovering it. I think of the Chris Jacobs case, if you're familiar. Is the state negligent if they don't follow up every ex-girlfriend of a defendant that was acquitted, and I mean that a bit seriously, you know, I mean, you make the point, not totally seriously, but a bit seriously, you make the point that how could you know 2 years before trial or a month after the event that he was going to be told in a bar and cut a hay or something. But if I were an avid investigator on a big case, mm-hmm. where there was an acquittal, where I was still looking around at the defendant. I mean, ex-girlfriends are just people I'd want to interview. The reason I go down this route is it seems to me a little cumbersome to get into the availability or unavailability question. It seems a bit cumbersome to say, was it reasonable for you to find something out? Why don't you do something? Why don't you go to a clearer and crisper thing rather than was it reasonable for you, the state, to find something out?
Okay. Well, I'd certainly be willing to consider a crisper or cleaner standard. What the state did, in fact, in this case, as I think our brief made clear, we erased, because it seemed to be fair and appropriate, for the state in this case, the same standard and rule for newly discovered evidence that this court is well familiar with and has for decades applied to defense motions for a new trial on the grounds of newly discovered evidence, with the five components of that test, the second one of which is that the moving party must not have been negligent in seeking to discover it. Now, I think we've got a fairly well-developed body of case law that deals with what is or is not negligence in seeking to discover information that's possibly material.
I'm not familiar with that, but what comes to mind is it has to be exceedingly fact-dependent. I look at that Bolden case, and I'm not sure, but my sense is that, you know, that it was important to the court that that statement was made after the conviction. I'm not talking about it being found out after the conviction. I'm talking about newly discovered evidence was unavailable because it didn't exist. And so the bright line, arguably, that they used is existence as opposed to availability. What do you think about that?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, I don't think that the Louisiana Supreme Court's decision in Bolden pivoted on that. I acknowledge, without question, the confession to the murder that was made to New Jersey authorities in the Bolden case a long time after the murders in Louisiana and after the trial in Louisiana had ended in acquittal. There's no question about the chronology there. It occurred afterwards. I don't think the case pivots on that, nor do I think the case should pivot on it for a number of reasons. One, I think it is appropriate, two major reasons. One, I think it is appropriate for this court to adopt an already existent, newly discovered evidence standard that it's familiar with and that I think the courts are familiar with. Number two, I think a key component, a key factor here to keep in mind is that to a considerable extent, the possibility of discovering, not to a considerable extent, to a complete extent, the possibility of the state discovering this evidence is almost totally dependent upon the defendant making the statement. The defendant remains in control of when that utterance is made and when others may hear it. In this case, this defendant, in Bartok and Cudahy, apparently bragged that he'd gotten away with something. It so happened that that occurred after the offense had occurred, but before the trial. I frankly don't see any principled basis for distinguishing why we would be in this case, and I certainly can't imagine making a different argument, if this statement was made and came to light after the trial. Frankly, Your Honor, I'd be making the exact same argument that the state, number one, I'd be making one addition to the argument if the statement were disclosed only after the conviction. We obviously couldn't have known about it before. But I think that's the only factual distinction. The question before was, could we have known about it before, and was the state negligent in not knowing about it?
The proper exception, though, would be narrower.
It would be narrower. I will certainly concede that, absolutely. So there's no question about that.
Counsel, I just want to follow. Let's say that, for illustration, we adopt the, your position. We have newly discovered evidence, and then there's a perjury trial.
Yes.
And Cannon is convicted of perjury.
Yes.
Now, what happens to the first trial where, can the state then go and, what do they do with the findings in the first trial? Can they reopen it?
No. No, immediately.
So that is clear. So we're only talking about perjury. You can't go back.
Absolutely. To a certain extent, right. The reason the state couldn't reopen the first trial, at least under existing law, there is no authority. It has been argued by some, it's been suggested by some commentators, but no court, to my knowledge, has yet so held.
So they have finality.
That double jeopardy concerns are set aside if you had a trial that where the result was procured by fraud. There have been some that have argued, suggested that such a holding might ultimately be made. We're not making such an argument. We're conceding in this case that under existing authority, the state couldn't reopen that first criminal traffic trial because however corruptly obtained that result was, it stands, and for double jeopardy purposes, you can't retry him on those charges. We're not seeking to retry the defendant on those charges, of course. We're seeking to prosecute him for the perjury he committed at that trial. For double jeopardy purposes, that is an entirely different offense, elementally distinguishable.
I want to know, counsel, just what you are either conceding or assuming, which means almost conceding.
Mm-hmm.
When you argue for an exception, it seems to me that you are conceding a rule that the doctrine of issue preclusion would bar a subsequent perjury prosecution when the ultimate issue was adjudicated in the earlier one, and it's that same issue that has to be adjudicated in the subsequent one. Are you conceding that general bar as a correct position of the law?
What we've argued here for, Your Honor, is a test or a principle, a rule, that we think fairly balances the double jeopardy interest reflected in the collateral estoppel doctrine of the defendant and the judicial court system and societal interest in making sure that trial proceedings are conducted appropriately and without the corruption of perjury. Now, that's why we've adopted the position we have. Frankly, the state could have advocated a more far-reaching position and said any time there is perjury at a first trial, regardless of whether the state has new evidence or not, the state ought to be allowed to prosecute the person for perjury.
Can I?
We're not arguing for that because we think a more appropriate balance, a position that more appropriately strikes a balance between the legitimate interests of the defendant in avoiding repeat prosecutions, the interest that the double jeopardy bar is designed to protect, and the societal interest in truth-telling at trial is a rule that says, you can prosecute when you have new evidence, but not when you're simply going to represent the first evidence.
Get you to tell me, that,
yeah,
rather than my words, tell me what you are conceding or assuming is the general law with regard to issue preclusion and a subsequent prosecution for perjury.
Okay.
Tell me what your rule of law is that you're conceding.
Okay, all right. Recognizing, of course, that there's at least two schools of thought present in the precedent that both sides have argued to the court, including the precedent that goes against us that we've acknowledged in our brief. Here's what we believe the law should be in Wisconsin. That even where an ultimate issue of fact is determined in the defendant's favor at the first trial, if the defendant testifying on that subject perjured himself, and if the state has new evidence to support that perjury trial, The perjury prosecution should go ahead, and collateral estoppel does not bar it. We are conceding here by not making the more far-reaching argument that if the only evidence the state has in those circumstances to prove perjury at a perjury trial is to represent the exact same evidence it had at the first trial and hope that a second jury would believe what the first jury didn't believe, that in those circumstances, collateral estoppel prevents the perjury.
The Court of Appeals, and I don't remember the exact language, but it essentially said they understood you to be be assuming or conceding that the ultimate issue on the perjury case had indeed been tried in this first case,
yeah.
And that is who was driving. Are you conceding that?
I think that goes a little bit farther than we either said or ought to be interpreted as saying. And here's
what I want to know.
On the record that's before this court, and on the record that's before the record that was before the circuit court, it appeared reasonable to believe that the critical issue at the first trial was whether or not Mr. Cannon was driving. But as we pointed out in the latter two arguments of our brief, we believe that as a general rule, and then as it specifically applies in this case, whenever a court is being asked to determine whether something was decided at a prior trial and that finding bars relitigation at a subsequent trial, the court needs to examine the entire record of what happened at the first trial. In this case, the record that was before the circuit court and before the Court of Appeals only included a few pages, an excerpt of the trial of Mr. Cannon's first criminal traffic trial, at which he testified that he was not the driver. Now, in our view, as a general rule, any time the doctrine of collateral estoppel is sought to be invoked, Esch versus Swenson and this court's several cases, including the Vassos case, makes clear that the court needs to examine the entire record to precisely determine whether an ultimate factual issue was in fact decided at the first trial. In our view, the circuit court could not make no such finding in this case, and neither could the Court of Appeals, and in fact, neither one of them really applied that principle, and the best they could say was, it appears, the circuit court said, it appears that the jury found that Mr. Cannon was not the driver. And the Court of Appeals said, because the jury determined there was insufficient proof that Cannon was driving, the trial court found the state was barred by the doctrine.
The Court of Appeals also says no rational jury could have grounded its verdict upon a reason other than that the state failed to prove Cannon was driving on the day in question. So they come a little bit stronger.
Yes, and I don't
think no rational jury could.
I understand that. And I think, I, with all due respect to the Court of Appeals, I'm reminded of the expression, well, so far as you know, the fact was, so far as the Court of Appeals knew, that was right. Because all that the Court of Appeals had before it was a very thin portion of the record, including only a few pages of the trial transcript.
Well,
now, as we pointed out in our brief, and as this court has noted, and I think as the Louisiana Supreme Court's decision Bolden notes as well, it's dangerous to infer from a general verdict of acquittal that a jury necessarily found X, Y, or Z fact. And I don't mean to split hairs, but I don't think this is. There's a difference between reading a jury verdict to say the defendant was not the driver. The jury must have found the defendant was not the driver, and the jury must have found that the defendant was telling the truth when he said it. There's a big difference between intuiting that finding by a jury from a general verdict of acquittal, or drawing the conclusion that the jury may simply have concluded that the state's evidence that he was the driver was insufficient. Those are two different things.
But you can never conclude the first.
Excuse me?
I said you never can conclude the first statement from a jury verdict. You can only conclude the state didn't prove the elements of the crime beyond a reasonable doubt. He's innocent.
Exactly. Although, and in only a very small handful of cases, such as Ash versus Swinson, where the collateral estoppel doctrine was applied, have any court said, after thoroughly examining the record of the prior trial, we can conclude that the jury must have found X, Y, or Z. That is what happened in Ash, but it did so only after it had thoroughly examined the entire record of the first trial.
But you're not trying to, according to your briefs, and I assume your oral argument, you're not attacking Ash.
We're not attacking Ash as being validly decided? No. We're arguing, in fact, we think it's distinguishable. It does not compel the result that the Court of Appeals, the Circuit Court, gave in this case.
And you're not attacking Vassos, which was a state case similarly, where the issue was, in effect, whether the verdict in the first case meant an acquittal of the second charge, regardless of whether it fit within Blockberger and that set of rules, etc. Then we go back and look at the record. So those are good laws, as far as you're concerned, at least in this case. And what you are doing is looking at only the concept of perjury.
Precisely.
As the second charge.
An elementally distinguishable crime, absolutely, yes.
And you're not asking this court to send this record, to send this back to determine, to look at the first trial or the evidence of the first trial, are you?
As I think we made clear in our brief, in our second and third major portions of the brief, we would argue that this court do that only if, as an alternative, this court is not persuaded by our initial argument, which is, regardless of what the jury's finding were, was, because there is new evidence in this case, the state does have the opportunity to prove perjury. Only if this court is unwilling to adopt that rule would we argue, do we argue, in fact, in our brief and in arguments 2 and 3, that this court, at the very least, ought to send it back to have the trial court review the complete record and do the proper review that Ash versus Swinson and Vassos requires.
So that your alternative is
an alternative.
Look at Ash. I can't remember Ash, although I just finished reading it, but I remember Vassos, that the two crimes were related and very close, and only because of our very technical kinds of the element situation. What was Ash?
Well, Ash was a robbery case.
Oh, yes, the two victims.
Six poker players robbed by a number of robbers all at the same time.
Right. And there, again, you just have a concept of different people involved, so you get within that same range of fuzziness. Here, the two crimes are so different.
Yes. And in Ash, Your Honor, and that's why I think we're not arguing that Ash was wrongly decided. We think it was properly decided. We just think it doesn't have the application here that the Court of Appeals and Circuit Court gave it. In Ash, the Supreme Court said, and this was a U.S. Supreme Court review of after the conviction had been upheld in the Missouri state courts on federal habeas review, the Supreme Court held, looking at what the federal courts had looked at, that a complete review of the record of Mr. Ash's first trial demonstrated that the only issue, the only genuine issue with the first trial, was whether or not he was the robber. Thus, it was necessarily decided, the court said, after thoroughly looking at the record, the jury in that case, even given the danger of trying to draw a specific conclusion from a general verdict, the only conclusion the jury could have based its decision on was that he wasn't the robber.
All right, let's just change the facts of this case, and let's have let's start first with the other guy who was driving, or was not driving.
Right.
The other person, companion, did testify.
Did not.
I know he didn't in this case. Suppose he testified and said, I wasn't driving, he was, and the jury acquits.
Okay. So let's say if at the first trial he had testified.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Jury acquits. Then you get him staying in a bar.
The defendant. Right. later saying to other persons.
I was the driver.
Yeah. Effectively, I was the driver, boy, we put one over on the Taylor County Court.
Right.
Yeah, sure. New evidence.
Same result in this case.
Same result.
Still charging with perjury.
Charged with perjury, we've got new evidence, absolutely.
All right. Now I'm going to put this person in the bar who has heard the defendant confess or make an admission. He now appears at that first trial and says, he told me in the bar he was the driver. And you have an acquittal. Then you get a witness that says, yeah, we put a fast one over on that court because I was the driver. Still have him on perjury.
Okay, where is that admission? Whose admission is that? The defendant's?
Defendant's.
You bet.
Still, I'm trying to change, get more and more evidence into that first trial.
Sure.
Where the jury can determine, in effect, lying.
Sure.
Because you've got contradictory evidence.
Right.
Still can bring him in on perjury.
Right. I could add another possibility. Let's have the defendant, Mr. Cannon, procures, persuades, induces Mr. Quesada or Mr. Pergandi to come to his trial and to testify falsely. And he's, can he?
Right.
And we find that out after the fact.
Right.
We prosecute him for perjury as a party to the crime.
Prosecute who?
We prosecute Mr. Cannon.
And the other guy.
Or procuring the perjury of another person. Sure, we can prosecute both of them for perjury. One, under 93905, one of them directly committed it, the other one aided or abetted or induced it. Conspired, caused it to be done. And again, if that's newly discovered evidence, we can charge both of them with perjury.
I suppose you could do it even on discovery issues. If there's been perjury on interrogatories or at a deposition.
Well, the only limitation, of course, is the limitation of the perjury statute itself, which, of course, limits prosecutions to the making of false material statements under oath. So if we're talking about sworn information in discovery, it's either a false swearing. It's going to be a false swearing charge, I think, probably, rather than a perjury charge.
Uh-huh.
But the perjury, of course, is limited to false testimony in court on a material element. So we're not talking about a danger here of the state running off on the basis of nitpicking newly discovered evidence afterwards, charging people on immaterial subject matter. What we want to do in this case is prosecute Mr. Cannon. What the Taylor County District Attorney wants to do is prosecute Mr. Cannon for falsely testifying on what appeared to be maybe the critical issue in the case, certainly one of the most highly material elements of the case.
Okay.
Is the newly discovered evidence constitutionally based, or how do you justify that?
How do we justify the principle that we're arguing for?
Yeah.
That we be allowed? Okay. Here's where it comes from. The defendant raised the defense of preclusion, collateral estoppel in this case, in a defensive manner, seeking to prohibit the state from proceeding with the perjury prosecution. We know from Ash versus Swenson that collateral estoppel, at least as it was applied in Ash versus Swenson, is viewed by the United States Supreme Court and by this court as a concept that is incorporated within the concept of double jeopardy. For my purposes, I've chosen to sort of think of double jeopardy as one very clear set of rules and collateral estoppel in criminal cases as kind of double jeopardy light. But it's a concept that's incorporated within it. The question is, when it was raised by Mr. Cannon in this case as a bar to the state under Ash versus Swenson, was Ash versus Swenson properly applied in this case? And our view is there was not. And there is no constitutional bar to the state seeking to prove an entirely separate crime, perjury. We would be barred constitutionally if Ash versus Swenson were properly applied to this case. Under Ash, it's a constitutional rule. As it viewed the matter and within the circumstances in that case, it was a constitutional bar to the state of Missouri prosecuting the defendant in that case more than once for the robbery that occurred at the poker game. In that case, they wanted to prosecute him six different times for committing the same crime with six different victims, all of which occurred at the same time. We're not trying to do that, and we think Ash is entirely and totally distinguishable. The principle of Ash is correct and intact. We believe it's just simply not applicable. So in our view, Justice Prosser, we see no constitutional bar to the state proceeding to prosecute Mr. Cannon for perjury, because we are not engaging in a violation of his double jeopardy rights, and neither are we engaging in a violation of his direct double jeopardy rights. Perjury is a different crime than OAR 4th. We're trying to prove perjury at this trial and criminal traffic charges at the other, so there's no double jeopardy bar. And there would be a collateral estoppel bar under double jeopardy, constitutionally based, if this was a case where Ash were applicable. We simply say, it's our view that it's not. So that it's not a question of where do we have a constitutional basis for the prosecution. There is a factual and legal basis for charging this defendant with perjury, and there is no constitutional or other legal bar that we are aware of that should appropriately prevent that from occurring.
Chief, may I ask a question? Do you agree that the defense at the first trial was that he was not driving?
That appears to be the case from the limited record that we have, yes.
Do you agree that the defendant has said that the defense at his first case was that he was not driving?
Absolutely, and in the excerpt of the testimony we have, it has him testifying to that. I was not the driver.
There's a footnote in Ash, footnote 9, that was raised in your opposing counsel's brief that suggests to me that you have to, you can't go around and say, well, what, maybe the jury believed or didn't believe something on an uncontested issue, or maybe the jury did this, or maybe the jury did that on an uncontested issue. The footnote says, if a later court is permitted to state that the jury may have disbelieved substantial and uncontradicted evidence of the prosecution on a point the defendant did not contest, the possible multiplicity of prosecutions is staggering. And it goes on to say this would be awful. That seems to be what you're arguing, though.
No.
There is no suggestion that I saw. I mean, in my mind, I was conjuring up things. Look, this is drunk driving. Maybe the state, maybe the jury didn't believe that he was intoxicated. But the only issue that was being contested, according to the defendant, and from the transcript, the only issue that he was contesting was that he was driving. Indeed, he was acquitted with operating after revocation also that same day. How do you reconcile your argument with the footnote in Ash that says you can't try to conjure up uncontested?
Okay. I don't think we're conjuring. My argument is different. My view is that the circuit court and the court of appeals both reached a conclusion without a proper basis for making it, because they didn't do what the court in Ash did, which is to look at the entire record of what happened and determine the entire record, both the transcript, all of the pleadings, any other circumstances that may have been involved in the first case. Only then, Ash says, and this court in Vasso says, can you make a determination of what a general verdict of acquittal in a criminal case did or did not find on a particular factual issue. That didn't happen here. As a result, and I want to emphasize this, we've got the circuit court saying it appears that the jury found that he was not the driver. And we have the court of appeals saying, from what's before us, the jury apparently felt that the state had not provided sufficient proof that he was the driver. We can't tell from the record that was before the circuit court and the court of appeals precisely what happened here. And I would point out as well, as this court noted in State versus Marhall, jury verdicts are sometimes based not on evidence at all, but on considerations of compromise, leniency, or even jury nullification. I don't know if that's what happened in this case. Someone needs to find out. And if the correct rule is applied, I think we will. And if the correct rule is applied, I believe the state will be allowed to prosecute Mr. Cannon for perjury. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gansmer. Mr. Eisenberg, representing the defendant, Mr. Cannon.
May it please the court. I wish to thank the court for allowing me to argue today. I last appeared before this court on Gas Company versus Annie Lee in 1966 with a venerable ancestor. Given the appear once every 35 years rule, I will not be here in 2035.
The rest of the court will be, Mr. Eisenberg.
I hope so. I guess because of our structure with the prosecutor trying matters in the trial court on criminal cases and the attorney general coming in at later stages, it seems that someone has lost sight of what this case is all about. We remind the court, as we asserted on page 4 of our brief, before the Supreme Court in the footnote, that it is ironic that the state subsequently charged Cannon with perjury when the state admittedly had virtually no evidence for the initial trial to prosecute the ultimate issue of fact or whether or not Cannon was driving. What is this all about? If you were to look at the trial court record, you know there was a trial. You know from all of the briefs and records that have been filed in this case, Pregandy never appeared. Now, I make a heavy point of that before this court. He never appeared. On the day of trial, they could have sent a squad to pick him up. The prosecutor wanted his statement used, denied by the trial court. The prosecutor then said, let's get him on the phone in front of the jury. And the same reasons that the prosecutor gave as to why he couldn't be there were used against the prosecutor to deny her permission to do that. This was somebody so infirm that the trial court said proceed or dismiss. Now, she could have dismissed. She could have dismissed at that point and asked for a dismissal without prejudice and tried to come back at a later time with Pregandy. What we have here is an abortive attempt to reconstruct what should have been properly done in the first place. What is wrong with that? We had to go through a whole trial. We had to face no evidence. And we got an acquittal. Why should that be any surprise, even to the great and noble Attorney General? What is wrong with that? Now, the state took the hard line at trial and contended that Mr. Cannon was lying. Only God and Mr. Cannon know that. Mr. Cannon said he wasn't driving. He was extremely drunk. Look at the facts. Let's try to make new and very bad law out of very bad facts. Two men are found urinating on the street, and the constable comes along and says, well, when he was driving, so I could kick him. And again, the state has virtually no evidence that Cannon was driving. Each man says the other man was driving. So they picked Cannon, and they lost. Now they want a rule that says, let's take a hard look at every acquitted defendant. They say, Supreme Court, give us a rule that will enable us to charge every acquitted defendant with perjury if we can come up with something new. I don't know if Mr. Quesada even exists. God knows, I'm trying to find out. I don't know if he exists. Look at his statement. He voluntarily mailed in a letter. It's totally constructive in lawyer language. That's Quesada's statement. He voluntarily mailed in a letter to the Taylor County District Attorney's Office. Now, let's go back to the basic facts here. The issue was Mr. Cannon driving? There was no issue that he was drunk. There was no issue that he was there. There was no issue that he was on a highway. The issue is, was he driving? There couldn't be a more narrowly focused issue. On a perjury prosecution, the only way that the state could establish that he committed perjury is if he knew he was driving and he lied about it. He had to have been driving in a perjury prosecution. There is no different issue. The state literally wants to relitigate the exact same identical issue. No matter how you question the state on that, he cannot dance away from that by making these hairline distinctions that are not distinctions at all. It's very simple. Mr. Cannon was not driving. There still is no evidence that he was driving. The claim that Mr. Quesada says he got away with something doesn't prove that he was driving. Now, let me address a completely different issue that is worthy of presentation on oral argument, partially because it was suggested by the state just now. Justice Prosser says, what's your basis for new evidence? Is it constitutional? Is it statutory? What is it? First of all, I contend that the Quesada statement is not evidence at all. It's pretended evidence. It's suggested evidence. How then could the state possibly have come in here claiming that it's evidence? Well, they could have. They could have. They could have if they had responded to what's buried in the questions that you've asked. And that is, if they discovered this shortly after the trial, why then didn't they take their statement and Mr. Quesada and Mr. Pergandy in person back in front of the trial court and say, this is new evidence. It's newly discovered evidence. Mr. Trial Court Judge, please take a look at this now. This would be newly discovered evidence. The same as any defense lawyer might try to come in with.
Well, and counsel, what would you have said if that was attempted?
I think it doesn't make some difference what I say. I think the trial judge might have taken a look at it. I can tell you this, the trial judge had Mr. Cannon on the stand. Not this court. The trial judge would have been able to say, I saw the testimony of Mr. Cannon. I now hear newly discovered evidence from Mr. Quesada, and I now hear the testimony of Mr. Pergandy. And he might have been able to be in a position to say there was a fraud on the court. He might have been able to be in that position.
As I understand the dates, counsel, the date of the statement to the district attorney was April 20th of 1998, and in the statement is the date that he was told July 2 years ago, which would have been July of 1996. Are those dates correct?
No.
At least as reflected.
At least as reflected, I don't know. I have never had an opportunity for discovery because this never got past the complaint stage and got thrown out. That is what's in the record.
Mr. Eisenberg, if the jury or the judge had come down and acquitted Mr. Cannon of driving, and then the state came in to the judge and said, we got new evidence What would the judge have done?
Let's take that one step further and say, let's say the state came in with a videotape of Mr. Tiemann driving on the deed in question captured by a television station. I think that the judge would have been permitted to look at it. The judge could have said, maybe we need a John Doe, maybe we need something else, but I think we need some forum for taking testimony on it, not just going, taking the case where it winds up in the next county on a complaint issued on unwitnessed, unverified, unsworn statements.
I think the judge would have said to the state, on motion of defense counsel,
which I probably would have made,
that this is double jeopardy. He's been acquitted, and that's it.
I agree.
And he could swear on a stack of Bibles that he did it, and you couldn't get him. But if he swore on a Bible, and, or he swore before court, that he didn't do it, and then swore thereafter that he did do it, then that's the state says, look, I can't charge you on murder again, I can't charge you on drunk driving again, because it's double jeopardy, even though it was a fraud on the court. That's my understanding.
We're looking at two different issues here. We're here today on the perjury issue, and you're talking about fraud on the court, and they're not the same. It seems to me that a court has an inherent authority to at least consider whether the court has been defrauded. And that's a different issue from perjury. But I think that if they are arguing, and of course I would certainly have the right on behalf of Cannon to assert double jeopardy at that time. But that's not to say that the court can't look at it.
For what purpose?
I don't know. Maybe to try and vacate a verdict, maybe to issue a contempt. Fraud on the court can be dealt with as a contempt. The court could say, we want to open a John Doe to look into this, to see who's been involved in it, take testimony. Pergani could have been brought in. There are a multitude of remedies. If you really want to get me going, I think that there are a lot of remedies. I'm going to tell you what's the worst part about this. The worst part about this, and this is in the record, is that no sooner does this prosecutor issue the charge than, consistent with what you're asking me, no sooner does she issue a charge.
Mr. Eisenberg, judge, please stand in front of the microphone because you're being recorded.
I'm so short, but I...
My eyes are so bad, so we're even.
Okay. No sooner does the prosecutor issue the perjury charge than she sends the defendant a plea bargain to plead to a misdemeanor and drop the perjury charge. That's before the motion can even be brought, and that's part of the record in this case.
Well, they're obviously angry at your client, Mr. Eisenberg.
She also says that she is doing it because she can't try him twice under the double jeopardy provision. And that's what gets lost between the DA's office and the Attorney General.
You think that the states have stopped from doing that as a result of that concession, a legal concession?
The state has stopped from doing anything in a second forum after the jury has issued its verdict. We think that it's both double jeopardy and collateral estoppel. This is just an attempt to make very new law out of very bad facts. Very bad facts.
Mr. Eisenberg, the rule that will come out of this case obviously goes beyond the individual circumstances. How is your answer in response to people who falsely testify on their own behalf in court that
someone should go before the judge in to initiate a contempt proceeding? Is that the remedy for this?
It's one of them, definitely.
Well, give me your whole host of remedies for perjury in court.
The trial court judge could, if he was convinced that justice had been obstructed and the court could have was obstructed and the jury was lied to, could make a finding of contempt. Depends how that information would come to the court. If the defendant were to come in and acknowledge it, it might be summary. There have been cases where the defendants have made such acknowledgments before the proceedings were concluded. There could be a formal criminal contempt charge brought if that were to happen.
Double jeopardy? Defense?
Possibly. Depends on the facts. In this case, the state concedes they have no case and took them to trial anyway. In this case, the state concedes that Pergami existed, had given a statement, and could have been made available for trial, and persisted anyway. They could have taken a dismissal without prejudice. They could have done all kinds of things here.
I'm sorry, interrupt. We were at criminal contempt. Civil contempt?
Certainly.
What other remedies are there? John Doe, you mentioned.
Whether we would assert collateral estoppel or not, the state could attempt to have the verdict vacated and set aside because it was obtained by fraud. That is what they're arguing here as the basis for their whole new rule. They want a new rule of new evidence so that a defendant who defrauds the court can't profit by it. And they want a new evidence rule. So I would assume they would try the same thing. They would attempt to have the verdict set aside, and yes, the defense would assert double jeopardy.
But I think that at least the question I asked opposing counsel was that they're not dealing with that. What they're dealing with here is at least as they describe it, are two distinct criminal acts. In other words, we're not dealing with this trial anymore. We're dealing with the person that perjured him or herself, and how would we as a in the administration of justice deal with that particular concern. So, I mean, I can see in Ash saying, well, you'd have the same transaction, but here you have something completely, you know, they're a couple of years out, the trial took place a couple of years ago. How would you deal with that? I'm talking, certainly you're talking of summary contempt or having a trial on contempt, but that's not, I don't think, realistic. How would you deal with that?
It's as unrealistic as charging Cannon with perjury. That's how I would deal with it. Yes, the same defense argument would apply, but I don't think this case is any more viable than those. There are other remedies, but I think it's more realistic. Instead of making an argument at another court at another day, I think the argument should first, if you're going to consider a new evidence rule, I think the new evidence rule should be directed back to the trial court. But this case doesn't generate a new evidence rule. And Ash versus Swenson and Vassos cover all of the re-prosecution arguments. This business of re-prosecuting somebody after an acquittal is not something new. It's been tried many times, many places, and the weight of authority seems to be the same. No matter what the mode is, if it's a re-prosecution as opposed to a completely different prosecution, and this is a re-prosecution, the weight of authority, they don't have a leg to stand on. And it's been considered by Ash versus Swenson and this court and Vassos and a host of other cases. DeFrancesca is another one. And no matter what the mode is, it's been rejected. And they don't need to make any new basis. They want a new rule for courts to be able to consider new evidence, and that doesn't fly on the basis of what happened in Cannon's case. It just doesn't fly.
Any questions of Mr. Eisenberg?
Yes, Justice Glassman.
In the record before us, Mr. Eisenberg, is there more record really than four pages of direct examination by you? I mean, what I'm really trying to get at is you said, well, he said he was drunk, but I don't see that in these four pages.
He didn't contest that because it didn't make any difference. Are you referring to my argument?
Yes.
Or are you referring to...
I'm referring to what you...
My final argument.
...in your argument right here, that the only issue was whether he was driving or not.
Right.
I got a sense that he said someplace, but I don't see it in front of me, that he had been drinking.
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
But not necessarily to the level that he was under the influence. That's...
No. He was so drunk, he couldn't possibly have been driving. That's what his argument was. I was so drunk that I couldn't possibly have been driving. That's why I turned the keys over to the other guy, because he was able to drive. I could not possibly have been driving, and I wasn't driving.
Okay. Now, I don't disbelieve what you're telling me, but how do I know that's true when it isn't in the record in front of me?
You don't. It wasn't my burden to put that in. I'm answering it because I was there. But that is exactly the answer. There is no question about the fact that Cam was intoxicated. That was never an issue. He never said I was sober or anything else. The sole issue is whether or not he was driving. And the state had every opportunity. I think in 2 years, they could have flatbedded Mr. Pergandy into court. They could have brought him in. And I begged the judge. I said, we're only a few hours away from where he is. Send a squad down to pick him up. Bring him in here with all these lame excuses. Get him in here this afternoon. Or the prosecutor can move to dismiss without prejudice. And the judge said, 2 years is long enough. We're going ahead. Either dismiss or go ahead. And she said, I'm going ahead. So what was I to do? Man took the stand. He said he wasn't driving. The state concedes they had no evidence at that time, at trial, that he was the driver. But they claim they had evidence. The record is clear on that. And they come in afterward with the same statement by Pergandy and some mysterious Mr. Quesada. And I don't see it.
Counsel, at page, in your brief,
yes.
You indicate that as an alternative argument, that the state waived an argument because the district attorney's agreement was that there was only one issue for trial. Is that part of this record where the district attorney agreed or conceded that there was only one issue for trial?
Yes.
Where?
You mean where is it in this record?
Yes.
It's not.
You seem to be arguing that your client was acquitted at the OWI trial and on the perjury, the case was dismissed, the state appeals, the court of appeals agrees with the perjury action being dismissed, the state seeks petition for review. You seem to be arguing that it's not your responsibility to complete the record. If you need more of a record, that the state should have been doing it with.
It's their appeal. There is no other issue anywhere in the record in the perjury case and appeals to this point. There is no other issue. The state has never claimed there is another issue. They haven't submitted a different issue. I don't have any other issue. I don't It's not my role to submit a record to disprove or prove the negative or disprove that there were no other issues. I would also, I'd also like to point out that on page 11 of my brief, the contention in mid-page, re-prosecution is based on new evidence not available at the first trial, are barred. See DeFrancesco versus United States 449 U.S. at 117 and 128, and Burks. That's based on new evidence not available at the first trial, but not available is different in this case, where the state has always conceded that Pergandi was available at first trial and prior to first trial. They've always known that. This stands for the proposition, new evidence not available at the first trial. So we're not talking about evidence that didn't exist and was known to the state. Yes, if they tried to come in on newly discovered evidence, they probably would have been shot down. It probably would have been shot down. But it seems to me that the trial court ought to get the first look at it before they go jumping off and throwing around perjury prosecutions at people. I think that they would like to do that in every case where someone is acquitted. We prosecute them for perjury.
Thank you, Mr. Thank you. Unless there are other questions. Thank you, Mr. Eisenberg. Mr. Gansner. Mr. Gansner, I assume from parts of your brief that if the court does not think the only issue was whether he was driving, that we would send it back and get more of the record.
Yes. Yes, precisely. That's what the state is arguing. And
does the court get more of the record or send it back to the trial court for more record?
Well, I think the appropriate place to send it back for would be the trial court. I think the kind of review of the record that Ash counsels is one that is best conducted within the trial court.
Have you looked at the entire record of the first case?
Of the first case?
Yes.
I've seen only the record that's come up on this appeal.
I have not seen
the entire record of the first case.
How do you respond to Mr. Eisenberg's argument that it was the responsibility of the government to present the whole record?
On several points, Mr. Eisenberg and I have a different view of both the record and the law. First of all, I can only make comments and refer to facts that are in the record. Secondly, with respect to the creation of a record, it was the defense in this case that asserted collateral estoppel as a defense, as a bar to the perjury prosecution. The existing law in Wisconsin and from the United States Supreme Court makes clear that a court acting on a collateral estoppel defense asserted defensively by the defendant must examine the entire record of the first proceeding to determine whether or not a fact issue at issue in the second proceeding was necessarily determined in the first proceeding.
That's Ash.
That simply didn't happen in this case. That is Ash. I think this is less a question of who has the burden of producing than what is the correct way for the circuit court to have proceeded. And we respectfully submit that the circuit court did not deal with this question in the appropriate fashion. If I was going to assess a burden in this case, and I don't really think it's necessary to do so, it would appear to me that the person asserting the defense of collateral estoppel, when the collateral estoppel standard says it applies only if after a full examination of the first record you reach a certain conclusion, would be on the party asserting the collateral estoppel preclusive defense. I think that should have been the responsibility of the defendant. In any event, the court should have examined the entire record, and it did not. But I do want to emphasize go ahead, Justice Bailey. Excuse me.
Are you urging a rule of law that when there is new evidence, the state is entitled to do this, or is it at the trial court's discretion?
Well, Your Honor, I think this rule is going to have to be applied by the trial court, and there's discretion involved in the application of the five-part newly discovered evidence test that we're urging be adopted in the same fashion that there is discretion involved in every trial court's application of the newly discovered evidence test when it's used as a basis for a new trial motion by a defendant. But we're arguing as a matter of law, this court should adopt this rule and let the trial courts, in the exercise of their judgment on the basis of fact findings before them, apply it.
Well, the newly discovered evidence in this case, I take, I've been assuming all along, is Mr. Quezada's letter.
Yes, his, that's right. Okay. Well,
let's assume
Mr. Cannon's admission made to Mr. Quezada.
Yeah.
Yes.
Which can't be testified to by Peregrand. It can only be testified to by Quezada. Mm-hmm. Now, let's assume that you go back to trial, that you prevail, you go to trial, and you lose again. The state loses.
Yep.
Month after trial, the district attorney gets another letter from Mr. Smith.
Another party.
Another party. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Said, this guy came back to us, and when the trial was over, Cannon was laughing in a bar, and I overheard him say that he fooled him again. Can the prosecutor initiate another prosecution for perjury?
If it's new evidence, and it's an admission from Mr. Cannon, there's certainly an opportunity for it. Will every prosecutor who's ever put in this kind of unusual situation have to exercise prosecutorial judgment? Of course.
Yeah.
But would there be a legal basis for such a prosecution? If it's new evidence, yes. But an important point that I think needs to be emphasized here. As Mr. Eisenberg argues that the defendant should have a choice of remedies, there should have been a contempt proceeding. There should have been a John Doe investigation. A John Doe investigation into what? His client's commission of perjury would be the...
Counsel, my concern is the new evidence test that you espouse,
yes,
set forth on page 34, mm-hmm, is just so darn easy to meet.
Boy, defense attorneys have been having a hard time for a long time meeting it, Your Honor. It's not that easy.
The evidence must have come to the moving party's knowledge after a trial.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to be... Any DA can get that kind of new evidence. I mean, that's by definition, if they would have had it available at the time of trial, they wouldn't get the first base. So, available only after trial.
Sure.
Number two, the moving party must not have been negligent to discover. How could I find out it was in the bar in Petahe?
Mm-hmm.
Number three, the evidence must be material to an issue. That's not so hard to prove. The issue is, did he do it or didn't he do it? Number four, the testimony must not be cumulative. That's hardly anything. Now, the fifth one is more difficult, but I would venture to say it's in the realm of speculation. It must be reasonably probable that a different result would be reached on a new trial. I mean, you've got any time you have someone coming up, who knows. So, I'm just concerned that, much like Justice Babbage's question, he can, be at a bar in Cutaway today, and then he can be in a bar in Vivette tomorrow, and he can just make the state, go around all these bars. And get,
Don't disparage bars in Vivette.
I've never been to Vivette.
There's an answer here, and it's, let's make certain it doesn't get lost in the concern about how often a defendant brags in bars that he's perjured himself, which is that, in our view, a fraud was committed upon a court. It's a fraud that has a name. It's called perjury.
Well,
it's falsely testifying before a court. And if this defendant wants to turn into a veritable evidence machine by going around the state spouting off in as many bars as he visits that he lied in the Taylor County Court, so be it. Let him live with the consequences of his loquaciousness. The fact is, if it's new evidence and it's newly discovered and the state wasn't negligent in discovering it, the state should have the opportunity to protect the integrity of the judicial process by prosecuting a person who brags about having perjured himself in a circuit court in a criminal case. That's what's really at issue here is an important and extremely important point. What Mr. Eisenberg argues for is that a defendant who successfully, Buffalo's reporting, who successfully corrupts a trial, whose lying is good enough to get an acquittal, has immunity for it because he was successful. That's an intolerable result, and one that this court ought not permit.
You're assuming that the new evidence is conclusive, and what you're saying is that the defendant is guilty.
That is. What we're saying is the state should have the opportunity to prove it. We've got probable cause to charge him. We've got evidence that we believe would convince a jury beyond a reasonable doubt, out of his own mouth, that he lied.
When you're saying that he corrupted the system, you are assuming his guilt.
We're proceeding in the belief, Your Honor, that we have evidence that would support a conviction. It would be unethical for the prosecutor to do otherwise. If we succeed at all the things we're achieving, we believe we are capable of achieving, then yes, that would be the end result of it. We should have an opportunity to protect the integrity of the judicial process and to protect the integrity of the truth-telling function of trials by prosecuting individuals in those rare cases. We're not talking about opening up a floodgate, contrary to what Mr. Eisenberg seems to be suggesting, that every defendant who gets acquitted can be prosecuted.
Counsel.
We're seeking, in this case, and what I assume would be a rare number of cases, to prosecute people when there is sufficient evidence to convict them of having perjured themselves.
Justice Sykes has a question.
Yes, well, on that note, since we finally cut to the chase about what the stakes are here, which are very important to me.
Yes.
If we're creating an exception for perjury prosecutions, which implicate double jeopardy only indirectly, as we talked about in your principal argument, why would we limit it to cases of newly discovered evidence?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Why would we limit the exception to cases of newly discovered evidence?
Well, Your Honor, we had a choice to make. The state had a choice to make in this case in advancing it. There have been those that have suggested that a more inclusive principle ought to be adopted, which is that even if the state has no evidence and you merely want to represent evidence from the first trial, you ought to be allowed to prosecute perjury. We're not arguing for that.
I'm not talking about a case where the state has no evidence or no evidence, as you just stated. I'm thinking about
no new evidence.
Are you familiar with the State versus Fritz case?
Nope, I'm going to draw a blank on it right now.
It's a case out of my court in Milwaukee County.
Yes.
And the defendant was charged with sexual assault of a 15-year-old girl.
Uh-huh.
And in pretrial negotiations and a charging conference with the district attorney,
yes,
with several witnesses present, including his attorney, the district attorney, an investigator, and I believe others,
right,
admitted the sex with the underage girl. Under those circumstances, there's no defense, since consent is not a defense.
Mm-hmm.
There was a negotiated issuance in which he was offered the opportunity, the plea agreement was that he plead to the negotiated issuance of a lesser charge, and that's what was issued, a lesser charge, not the original felony charge, at which point he changed his mind, fired his attorney, secured another attorney, took the case to trial, the prosecutor filed the original offense, and the defendant and the defense attorney conspired to put in false testimony, his own, denying the sex. Again, as allegedly here, the only issue was whether they had sex. Consent's not a defense. So it was he said, she said. And in that case, the jury convicted, so we had a whole separate set of post-conviction issues and issues on appeal. But had he been acquitted, under your proposed test, the state could not charge him with perjury based upon all of the witnesses to his admission.
I understand.
Is that a good result?
I don't think it's the best possible result, certainly not in that case. But what we're arguing before this court is at least a form of incrementalism. We've got a case now on the facts before this court where new evidence supported a perjury charge. And certainly in that case, we believe the collateral estoppel should not bar. The day may well arise, Justice Sykes, when that case comes before this court and the state is arguing for an expansion of this rule. But we're arguing now, what we think is a modest and fair proposal that covers this case, which says when there is new state, surely, in order to protect the integrity of the judicial process, ought to be able to prosecute for perjury. We're not seeking, we realize that it's in a situation where there's no new evidence, that the defendant, the double jeopardy concern, that the state is merely retrying the play before a second audience, hoping to get a better review. That the defendant's argument in that case has the defendant's double jeopardy concerns have the most powerful basis to them, that the state should only be allowed to prosecute once. But in this case, we've got entirely new evidence that wasn't there before. And in those circumstances, we believe the calculus changes and that the state ought to be permitted. The sorry circumstances that your case revealed, if you changed, twisted the facts slightly different and had a different result at the first trial, would present a really fascinating case.
Counsel, I have just want to clean up two things. As I understand it, the state, for purposes of its first argument, concedes that the ultimate issue of fact determined in the first case was in the defendant's favor, that is, he was not driving.
No, I'm not, what we're saying, even if that is true,
that's right.
This court need not find that. But even if it was true, the state should still be allowed to prosecute for perjury.
So if we take that,
yes.
We don't have to go back and
no.
look at it.
No.
That's your first argument.
Yes.
If the court's not willing to go that far, then we have to send it back to determine whether the issue was he drunk, as Justice Prosser stated, or what.
At the very least.
Right.
At the very least. At the very least, Your Honor, the law of collateral estoppel needs to be cleaned up here. Yes.
The second, and then you still have left the issue of whether you can bring in perjury, but that would be under Ash. The second issue I have is this. I wonder if you responded too quickly to Justice Ballasch. If you charge, you were successful in charging him with perjury, and he was then acquitted of perjury, can you bring subsequent charges of perjury for subsequent admissions that he perjured himself? And you said yes. I suggest that it would not be permissible under Ash.
No. Your Honor, let me apologize. I believe I misunderstood Justice Babbage's question.
I think that was your question.
No. If your question...
that at the second trial, Mr. Cannon got up and said, I wasn't driving.
Yeah, it wasn't a... I think Justice Ballasch's question was that the second trial was not a perjury trial, Justice Abramson, but...
No, it was a perjury charge.
That is what you're saying. And he's acquitted of the perjury?
Right.
Oh,
now he says, look, I now perjured myself twice on the same issue. Right. I was driving. I don't think under... I suggest to you that the state may have spoken too quickly.
No, I misunderstood Justice Ballasch's question. If we're talking about... Let me put it in this context. The state cannot re-prosecute for perjury simply by representing that evidence again. If there was new evidence that the perjury was committed at the second trial,
that's what his question was. And you say then.
Then I believe that you can. If what we have is because there's a different perjury committed every time a defendant falsely testifies. If a defendant falsely testifies on one occasion and then falsely testifies on another occasion, you have two counts of perjury.
I believe
the answer to the question is the state would be allowed to if it had new evidence to support. Yes.
Thank you. That concludes the argument in this case. Thank you, Mr. Eisenberg. Thank you, Mr. Ganser.
Thank you.
Reports and recess to one.